King Apepe's entourage remained in Thebes for almost a month after the wedding. They were the guests of Pharaoh Nefertiti and of his regent, and they were entertained in royal fashion. Taita encouraged this delay. He felt certain that Naja would take no action against Nefer while Apepe and his daughter were in Thebes. The royal visitors spent their days hunting or hawking, visiting the numerous temples on both banks of the river dedicated to all the gods of Egypt, or in tournaments between the regiments of the northern and southern kingdom. There were chariot races, archery contests, and foot races. There were even swimming races, in which the chosen champions swam the full width of the Nile for a prize of a golden statue of Horus. Out in the desert they hunted gazelle and oryx from speeding chariots, or hawked for the great bustard with the swift sakers. No royal falcons remained in the palace mews, for they had been released into the wild during the funeral rites of Nefer's father. Along the riverbank the guests hawked for herons and duck, and speared the huge whiskered catfish in the shallows. They hunted the river horse, the mighty hippopotamus, from the fleet war galleys, with Nefer at the tiller of his own galley, named the Eye of Horus. Princess Mintaka stood beside him and shrieked with excitement as the great beasts broke the surface, their backs studded with spears, and the waters turned pink with their blood. During these days Mintaka was often at Nefer's side. She rode in his chariot when they hunted, and handed him the lance when they drove up alongside a galloping oryx. She carried her own falcon on her arm as they quartered the reed beds for heron. At the hunting picnics in the desert, she sat beside him and prepared little treats for him. She selected the sweetest grapes for him, and peeled them with her long, tapered fingers, and then popped them into his mouth. Every evening there were banquets in the palace, and there also she sat at his left side, the traditional place for a woman, so that she never blocked her man's sword arm. She made him laugh with her wry wit, and she was a marvellous mimic. She imitated Heseret to perfection, simpering and rolling her eyes and speaking of "my husband, the regent of Egypt," in the portentous tones that Heseret now employed. Though they tried, they were never completely alone. Naja and Apepe thought of that. When Nefer appealed to Taita for assistance, not even he could manoeuvre a secret meeting for them. It never occurred to Nefer that Taita did not exert himself to do so, or that he was as set on keeping them innocent as the others were. Long ago, Taita had engineered a tryst for Tarnus and his beloved Lostris, and the consequences still echoed like thunder down the years. When Nefer and Mintaka played Baal, there was always an audience of slave girls, while the courtiers and ubiquitous Lord Asmor hovered nearby. Nefer had learned his lesson well, and no longer underrated Mintaka's skill on the board. He played against her as if he were matched against Taita. He came to learn her strengths, and to recognise her few weaknesses. She was always overprotective of her home castle, and if he pressed her hard in that quadrant, she might sometimes offer an opening in her flanks. Twice he exploited this and broke up her defence. But the third time he discovered too late that she had anticipated this tactic and had laid a trap. When he had exposed his west castle, she rammed a phalanx through the gap and laughed so deliciously when he was forced to capitulate that he almost, but not quite, forgave her. Their bouts became ever more keenly contested, and in the end were of epic proportions, so that even Taita spent hours watching them, and occasionally nodding his approval, or smiling his thin, ancient smile. Their love was so apparent that it cast a glow upon all those round them, and wherever they went together there were smiles and laughter. As Nefer's chariot sped through the streets of Thebes, with Mintaka on the footplate as his lance-bearer, her dark hair flowing in the wind like a banner, the good wives ran out of their houses, and the men paused from their labours to shout greetings and good wishes. Even Naja smiled benignly upon them, and none would have believed that he fiercely resented the attention of the populace having been diverted from his own nuptials and brides. Lord Trock was the only sombre presence at the hunting parties, the picnics in the countryside, and the banquets in the palace. Their time together sped by too fast. "There are always so many people round us," Nefer whispered over the bayo-board. "I long to be alone with you even for just a few minutes. There are only 3 more days before you have to return to Avaris with your father. It might be months, even years, before we meet again. And there's so much I want to tell you, but not with all these eyes and ears pointed at us like knocked arrows." She nodded, then reached across and moved a stone that in his preoccupation he had overlooked. He glanced down and almost discounted it, until he realized that his west castle was now under a forked attack. 3 moves later, she had broken his front. He kept up the losing battle for a while longer, but his forces were in disarray, and the outcome was inevitable. "You caught me when I was distracted by other things," he groused. "So much like a woman." "Your Majesty, I make no claim to being anything else than a woman." She used his title with an irony that bit like the jeweled dagger she wore on her belt. And she leant close and whispered, "If I were alone with you, would you promise to respect my chastity?" "I swear by the wounded eye of the great god Horus that I will never, as long as I live, cause you shame," he told her earnestly. She smiled at him. "My brothers will not be overpleased to hear that. They would welcome an excuse to slit your throat." She slanted those magnificent eyes at him. "Or failing your throat, some other part of you might satisfy them." Their chance came the next day. One of the royal huntsmen came in from the hills above the village of Dubba to report that a lion had come out of the eastern wilderness and raided the cattle pens during the night. It had jumped the stockade and killed 8 of the terrified beasts. In the dawn, a horde of villagers, brandishing burning torches, blowing horns, beating drums, and screaming wildly, had driven it off. "When did this happen?" asked Nadja.
3 nights ago, Your Grace."
The man was prostrate before the throne.
"I came up river as soon as I could, but the current runs strongly and the winds were fluky."
"What's happened to the beast?" King Apepi interrupted eagerly.
"It's gone back into the hills, but I've sent 2 of my best Nubian trackers to follow it."
"Did any man see it? What size is it? Lion or lioness?"
"The villagers say it was a large male, the full mane, thick and black."
Up until the last 60 years, lions had been almost unheard of in the lands along the river. They were royal game, and had been hunted ruthlessly by successive pharaohs, not only because of the damage they inflicted on the livestock of the peasant farmers, but also because they were the most sought-after trophy of the royal hunt. During the long, bitter struggle of the Hyksos Wars, the pharaohs of both kingdoms had been preoccupied, and the lions had been hunted seldom. In addition, the human corpses left on the battlefields had provided an easy source of food for the lion prides. In the last few decades they had flourished. Their numbers had increased manyfold, and so had their boldness.
"I'll have the chariots loaded up onto the boats at once," Apepi decided. "With the state of the river we can be at Dubba early tomorrow morning."
He grinned and punched his fist into the horny palm of his sword hand.
"By Siwath, I'd like a chance at this old black mane. Since I've had to give up killing Egyptians, I'm starved for real sport."
Nadja frowned at the sally.
"Majesty, you're expected to sail back to Avaris the day after tomorrow morning."
"You're right, Regent. However, most of our baggage is already loaded, and the fleet lies ready to depart. Moreover, Dubba lies on my way homeward. I can afford a day or two to join in the hunt."
Nadja hesitated. He was not so addicted to the hunt that he wished to neglect the numerous affairs of state that awaited his attention. He had looked forward to the departure of Apepi, whose boisterous, uncouth presence in Thebes had long since palled. Also, he had other plans afoot which could only be furthered once Apepi had left Thebes.
Yet he could not allow the Hyksosian pharaoh to hunt alone in the upper kingdom. Not only would it be churlish to do so, but it would be impolitic to let Apepi behave in the southern kingdom as though he had sole right to it.
"Your Majesty," Nefer intervened, before Naja could compose a suitable refusal, "we'll join in the hunt with the greatest of pleasure."
He saw an opportunity for magnificent sport, for he'd never had the chance to run down a lion in his chariot and test his own courage by standing down the charge. But 100 times more important, the hunt might also delay Mintaka's dreaded departure. This happy circumstance might even provide the opportunity that had so far eluded them for spending a short time alone. Before Naja could prevent him, Nefer had turned to the huntsman, who still lay with his forehead pressed to the tile floor.
"Well done, my good fellow. The Chamberlain will give you a gold ring for your trouble. Return to Daba at once, in the fastest Falaka in our fleet. Make ready for our arrival. We'll go after this beast in full array."
Nefer's only cause for regret was that Taita would not be with him during his first lion hunt to offer counsel and advice. The old man had disappeared into the wilderness on another of his periodic and mysterious forays, and no one knew when he would return.